As for the term Bhavsava, that is to say, Sava or mania of existence, this almost brings us to the same point, if by Bhava we understand the becoming inherent in a birth, and in the assuming of a conditioned form. But, in a broader and deeper sense, we may see in the destruction of this Sava the equivalent of what Germanic mysticism called Entwerdung, the overcoming of becoming in general. The realization of the Aurya leads beyond both being and becoming. Together with ignorance and craving, the other two Sava, the bond of becoming is destroyed at the roots by the clear vision that arrives as a sudden flash of knowledge in face of Dukkha, the primordial agitation and contingency, and which gives realization of that incomparable safety, of the state wherein there is no more becoming, which is the end of the world, the end of going, the end of birth and of death. Finally, the formula. Katam Karanyam, that which had to be done has been done, is the extreme expression of the Ariyang nobility. The whole work has been done because it had to be done. There are no reasons. There are no rewards. It is natural for the man whose spirit is Ariyang to feel these values, to desire this undertaking. The right state, in the highest sense, is that of a being who no longer thirsts, who has extinguished craving, who has made his own the Olympian and sidereal nature, as in the origins. In point of practice, what we have said of the character of totality of the kasina is valid also for the yatana. The mind, entirely recollected and unattached, receives the basic idea of each yatana, infinite ether, infinity of consciousness, etc., and 5, page 75 in the English translation of the Dhammasatagani. 16, Umaj, 75. 173. Realizes its content in an experience that brings about the corresponding transformation. To use a Buddhist simile, the spirit has become like a jar full to the brim with water, so that it only has to be tipped in one direction or another for the water immediately to overflow in that direction. Here, in the complete concentration of the inner being that is detached from the senses and from the bond of the samsaric eye, the images have the power of transformation, to think infinite ether, infinity of consciousness, non-existence, and so on, means to evoke the corresponding state, to transform the mind into that state, so that it undergoes the corresponding infinitization and liberation. We can, furthermore, say of the yatana what we said of the jhna, with reference both to actions that must have an almost spontaneous character, to the neutralization of any tendency toward identification, and finally to the burning process that in every state, even at these heights, discloses something that is conditioned and that may he overcome, thus urging one ever forward. This is about all that can be said of the five states of ascetic realization in the planes free from form. The indications concerning them in the texts are extremely schematic. Here begins that silence, which will later be absolute, at least in original Buddhism, about the essence of the state of extinction, about Nibbana, SKT, Nirvana, and about the destiny of the awakened one after death. We now have shortly to discuss the other path to extinction, the path considered by another series of texts, and that is no longer given as a journey across the world beyond form, but rather in terms of special visions and corresponding births. For our point of departure, we must refer back to the state of consciousness corresponding to the fourth jhna or to the fourth irradiant contemplation, that is to say, to an extreme, purified equanimity, to the state of mind that the ascetic must assume in order to operate are attributed qualities similar to those of the pure, clear, ductile, flexible, resplendent indifference. The fixed canonical formula is, with firm, purified, tense, sincere, unblemished, malleable, ductile, compact, incorruptible mind. With such a mind one strives first of all for achievement of what is known as Jnanadasana, the vision that comes from knowledge, having as its object one's own person, in its totality. It is, as it were, the uncoupling of oneself or, better still, a liberating of oneself by self-division, carried out by contemplation of oneself, both in one's own somatic reality and in one's subtle reality, as if one were another person or thing. In fact, it is said that after the fourth jhna one must hold fast, one must consider in one's mind and penetrate with one's vision the object of self-contemplation, Pakavekhananamitta, just as one man might look at another, the one standing look. 17. Compare to Madge, 44, 64, 106, Angot, 10.29, 9.31, 10.72. The passage from one arupa to another occurs at the moment of feeling, firstly, form and the reflex images as a disturbance and impurity, then the KSA or ether element is so felt, then infinity of consciousness, then non-existence, then the element beyond perception and non-perception, then determination. 174. Ing at him who sits, the one sitting looking at him who stands, 18 it is, then, an extreme intensification of the process that began with the various contemplations on the body and on the mind during the consolidation phase, a process that now passes on to an objective stage that is designed to eliminate completely the bond of I, and that is distinguished by this characteristic. That which now does the contemplating is the almost ultra-human mind of one who has reached the fourth JHNA or who has followed the path that leads to the possibility of a state of union with Brahm. The formula of the disidentification or projection is, this is my body, provided with form, made up of the four elements, generated by a father and by a mother, maintained in life by these foods. It is impermanent, subject to change and decay, breakup and dissolution. And this also is my vina from which it proceeds and to which it is bound. A simile is given, as though on a cloth there lay a gem, a very pure, resplendent, clear, transparent, perfectly cut, and facete jewel, wholly excellent, there might he tied to it a thread, blue or yellow, red or white, and as though a man with good sight, taking it in his hand, were to consider it and see clearly how the one thing was joined to the other. This simile, taken from Smkhya, shows that it is a question of exteriorizing one's own person in its entirety. The term vina here refers to the subtle principle that organizes and gives life to bodily form. But this knowing, at present, only serves as a preparatory phase. This same firm, purified, tense, sincere, unblemished, malleable, ductile, compact, incorruptible mind is directed toward a further knowing, toward the vision of previous forms of existence. There arises the memory vision of many previous forms of existence, of one life, of two lives, of three lives, and so back through whole series of lives in the periods both of the coming to be and of the dissolution of worlds. There was one, I had such a name, I belonged to such a people, such was my state, such my office, this good and this evil I experienced, thus was the end of my life. Having passed on from there, I entered again into existence in such a manner, the ascetic recalls multiple forms of existence, each with its own characteristics, each with its own special relationships. A simile is given, as if a man were to go from one village to another and from there to another and finally were to return home and, in recollecting, should think thus, I, then, went from one village to another, where I stood thus, one sat thus, I spoke thus, tea kept silent thus, from that village I went to another, where I did thus and thus, and finally I returned to my village, the country of the ancestors. This is the first knowing, the precise term is Pabinivsana, a revealing vision having as counterpart an interior liberation, a definite self-elevation beyond the samsaric group to which a given particular individual existence belongs, and which now appears as a mere episode. 18. Angot, 5.28. 175. The next experience concerns a celestial, clarified, superhuman eye, it is called Dibhakakunene, which develops the vision, no longer of one's own existences, but of other samsaric groups, of the appearance and disappearance of beings in the sequence that is determined by the law of action, of comma. With this celestial, clarified, superhuman eye the ascetic sees beings disappear and appear, beings that are common and noble, ugly and beautiful, happy and unhappy, and he apprehends that beings always appear in life according to their actions. Here, too, we have a simile, as if there were two buildings with doors, and a man with good sight, standing between them, were to see people leaving one house and entering the other, going and coming. This power of vision, by means of which the contingency of the various forms of existence is directly contemplated from a universal, celestial standpoint, provides the final catharsis, leads to pan or body, to liberation, illumination, and extinction, to the same culmination that crowned and resolved the series of the five yatana, of the five reintegrations in the sphere beyond form. We have, then, as the third and last knowing, the vision of the conditioned genesis that determines the round of rebirth of beings, the vision of that which lies at the root of the genesis, of that which is its end, and of the states that lead to this end. At this point the Sava disappear, there occurs the redemption of the mind without main ears, and again we have the formula, exhausted is life, the divine path achieved, that which had to be done has been done, this world no longer exists. There is a final simile, dealing with the crystallinity, the absolute transparency and clarity of this vision that brings to an end the entire catharsis, as if a man with good sight were to stand on the banks of an alpine valley lake and, completely aware, were to consider the shells and the snails, the gravel and the sand and the schools. A fish, how they dart about all lie still. Point 19. Apart from the initial projection of oneself, this second path has thus three stages. It is important to emphasize that in some canonical texts, they are related, respectively, to the three watches, yama, of the night. Thus, the Buddha says, this knowing, that is, the first, the vision of one's own multiple, previous states of existence, I first apprehended in the first watch of the night, I dispersed ignorance, I apprehended wisdom. I dispersed obscurity. I apprehended light, whilst I dwelt striving ardently, watchful and strenuous. The same formula is repeated for the other two knowings. The disappearance and reappearance of beings is the second knowing to be apprehended in the middle watch of the night, and the final, liberating vision is the third to be achieved in the last watch of the night. Point 20. In one text, it is said, when the dawn is about to break, at the moment in which sleep is so profound and 9, on all this see die, 2.93-98, compare to Maj. 77. 20, Angat, 8.11, Maj. 4. In particular, on the experience, in the watches of the night, of the conditioned genesis and of the conditioned removal of its effects, compare to Mahavarga, VIN, 1.1.2. 176. To wake so difficult. Another point, the three knowings have also been related to so many immaterial births, apaptika. There is the simile of the hen that has completely incubated her eggs and is waiting for them to hatch and for the new being to arise from them, safe and sound. The warmth that nourishes this symbolical birth is that of asesis, tapas. At the moment in which the knowing of the various previous tales of existence is apprehended, the ascetic, it is said, is for the first time closed, like the chick come out of the shell. This first birth, beyond physical, samsaric birth, is the growth beyond one's own individuality, a growth that is bound up with the ability to gaze beyond the temporal limits of an individual existence, to see the whole group to which it belongs. A second opening is achieved with the knowing of the passing and uprising of beings and finally, a third when the sudden flash of knowledge destroys the sav and determines the state of Nibbana. Point 2. Each of the three transcendental knowings it is, then, an awakening, an opening, a change o state, the passage from one mode of being to another, from one world to another. Thus we find in Buddhism a traditional symbolism that is used in many forms o initiation, probably in connection with similar experiences. Besides these three births which are of a real nature, there is a birth that is symbolical and, above all, moral, the rebirth with the birth of the Ariya, or the I-blessed birth, refer to the man who makes the break, who achieves departure, and who devotes himself to the path of awakening. Point 22, we must give an explanation of this new group of transcendental experiences also. It is essential here to distinguish between the deepest content of the doctrine and that which refers to the popular exposition and that cannot be taken in an absolute sense, paramathavasina. To begin with, at this point, we must forestall the idea that not only is the theory of reincarnation assumed by the Buddhist teaching, but that it is, in fact, demonstrated by a direct form of transcendental knowledge in the shape of an actual memory it might seem, that is to say, that the situation were thus, that one single being having lived several lives or, at least, several forms of existence, could, at a particular moment, see retrospectively. Such an interpretation, in spite of all appearances, would be mistaken. In order to understand the true sense of these experiences, we must always remember their point of departure, that is, NPA Dasana, the vision or projection of one's own person that allows of its consideration as a thing or as the person o another. In this there occurs, in a manner of speaking, the fulfillment of all the litho of severance from one's own I, from one's own individuality, which has beat. 21. Angot, 8.11, Maj. 53. Samyut, 22.101. 22. Maj. 86. We also find the image of the snake that sloughs its old skin, compare to Suttanipata. 1.1.1 if 177. Carried out in the preceding ascesis. This means that one has become integrated in a new dimension or at a new level, an integration that is inevitably accompanied by a loosening. Consciousness is no longer tied to a particular name and form, it can move, it can take on the person of other people, both in space and in time. This is the foundation of the first two transcendental knowings, the vision of many preceding forms of existence, superindividuality in time, and the vision of the disappearance and reappearance of other beings, superindividuality in space, that is to say, with regard to various individual lives co-present in space. With reference to the first experience, we could speak, in a certain sense, of memory, but not as though it were one particular I that remembered having lived other lives or, more generally, having passed through other forms of existence. We can see that this would be absurd for the simple reason that the condition for achieving such a memory is no longer to be in one, to he free from I or from the consciousness connected with a particular name and form and with a particular life. We are no longer dealing with the memory of an I, but with the emergence, in the individual consciousness, of samsaric consciousness, with the memories associated with the groups of craving, or demon, or antarabva with which one was identified, for, as we saw, one does not adopt a name and form, a physiopsychical organism drawn from nowhere, but a more or less preformed samsaric force carrying with it a heredity, a complex of tendencies, which continue from the dead lives in which this force was previously active. The continuity and therefore also the basis of memory is contained in this force, it is not contained in an identical and permanent I to which Buddhism rightly denies an existence on the samsaric plane. At the moment when consciousness becomes disindividualized, breaks the bond of the samsaric I, and becomes universal, this same samsaric memory is spread out clearly before it. The very moment of one's dissociation from the demon, or double, is the moment in which one comes to know it. This is the deeper meaning of the first knowing, of this memory of preceding forms of existence. In the second knowing there is an increase in the power of the disindividualized consciousness, a consciousness that now extends not only along time and along the group of that particular entity of craving with which it was identified, but also in space, since it becomes capable of identifying itself also with other beings and of examining the samsaric heredity that determines them, the will of craving in which they live and where are determined the causes, when the material of one life is consumed, for the same flame to flare up elsewhere in strict accordance with its antecedents. Thus it is that, in these experiences, we can see the counterpart of liberations that are exactly similar to those of the ascetic who advances through the live planes free from form. In fact, it is not by chance that we have spoken not of a multiple 178. Lives, but rather of multiple states of existence. The assumption of the person of other people, which we have mentioned, is by no means restricted to human lives in space and time, but includes also extraterrestrial lines of existence and of heredity. Now, all this is possible only if one reaches a dimension to he compared to the depths of the ocean, where all the insular and continental parts emerging from the water as separate things are unified in a single mass. We are thus brought back to images of immensity, vastness, immeasurableness, indiscernibility. About such images we shall have more to say later. And it is natural that the texts refuse to apply to the accomplished one, who has followed this path to the end, any category whatsoever that, in common speech, takes its meaning from the existence or non-existence, from the life or death of an individual being. Thus the theory of reincarnation is rejected from two points of view, firstly from the point of view of ordinary, samsaric beings, since it is not the same being that has already lived nor that will live again, but rather the groups of craving working in him. On this plane a real substantial I does not exist. Secondly, from the point of view of transcendental illumination, since from this point of view the many existences can only represent a mirage. The one who contemplates them can no longer be considered as an I, and he is now also about to break the law that from one samsaric group there must spring a new existence. As we shall see, the Buddhist teaching also considers intermediate cases, that is to say, cases of incomplete extinction, but for further states of existence or for new lives, in the degree in which extinction is not complete, what we have said about the ordinary man is to a large extent still valid. There is no proper continuity, there are only transformations that affect also the substratum. Buddhism maintains this view in connection with the mental body and with the body free from form which varies. Texts attribute to the accomplished one, the term body here being used in a general sense, implying other states and modes of being relative to the worlds, beyond the physical one, that are reached by the jhana. The question was asked if such bodies exist simultaneously. The answer is negative. But the doctrine goes still further, the passage from one to another of these states does not present a true continuity. The transformations are absolute, as in the aforesaid simile of the milk that becomes curd and curd that becomes cheese. It is absurd still to call curd milk or cheese curd. In changing the state, it is well also to change the name. Point 23 with still more reason, the idea of an absolute identity of the I in the states to which a partial liberation may lead is to be rejected. On the subject of reincarnations and of many lives, we must remember that, in spite of the opinions held in some circles, such ideas find no place in serious traditional teachings, Eastern or Western, nor therefore in Buddhism. Those passages in 23, DGHA, 9.39, 47-53, 179. Buddhism and in the Indo-Aryan traditions in general that would seem to indicate the contrary do so either because of a too literal reading of the texts or because they are popular forms of exposition that only have a symbolical value, rather like the crude images of the Christian purgatory or hell that are common among simple folk. To accept unquestioningly all that can be found in the Buddhist texts on the subject of preceding existences not only opens the way to all sorts of contradictions and incoherences on the doctrinal level, but also breeds doubts as to the efficacy of the historical Buddha's real supernormal vision. The stories in the canon, and particularly in the Jataka, of the presumed previous existences of Prince Siddhartha, notably in the form of animals, are all evidently of a fabulous nature and, even when their origin is not wholly spurious, it is easy to see that they have been invented or introduced into Buddhism from already existing popular traditions for pedagogic use to illustrate and enliven discourses. We do not find, in the texts, a single serious reference to anything like a hemimeria, like an actual fact of the past seen by supernormal means and then communicated. Here, also, the awakened one maintains his silence. In any case, the classical and dryly glittering spirit of original Buddhism, so free of sentimentalism, is rarely found in the later texts, beginning with the Jataka, where not only is there a tropical overgrowth of phantasmagorical and fabulous elements, but also not a few distortions of the original doctrine of the Arya, particularly on the moral plane. It will be enough to remember, one case will serve for a whole series of others, the story dealing with the preceding life of Prince Siddhartha, wherein he is supposed to have been an animal that, upon seeing a hungry tiger, allowed itself to be torn to pieces through compassion, thus acquiring the merit that, through the series of other lives, was little by little to lead him to the grade of awakened one. Whenever higher wisdom is not enclosed in the form of rigorous esotericism, true esotericism, not that of contemporary occultists, such alterations are almost inevitable, and it is for intelligent people to discriminate accurately, to pick out the essentials, or to clarify what has become obscure, which can be done only by the guidance of sound principles of a traditional and metaphysical kind. We must mention another point. We have seen that the three supernormal knowings have been related by the texts to the first, second, and third watches of the night, respectively. This is an important fact once we remember the Indo-Aryan teachings on the four states, the state of individual wakeful consciousness, the state of dreaming, the state of sleep, and finally, the so-called fourth state, Katirtha or Turiya. In the same space in which, when individual wakeful consciousness disappears, the ordinary man starts to dream, passes into the unconsciousness of dreamless sleep, and finally into a state like apparent death, it is possible to achieve, instead, a series of liberations, of degrees of superconsciousness. In this connection, the state of dreaming, that is to say, what would correspond to dreaming in the 180? Ordinary man is called by the texts Tejo, from Tejas, which means radiant light, and which is related to what we have said about KSA, ether, the state of deep, dreamless sleeps where there is no knowledge, but the subject of knowledge continues to know, is related to the condition of prajñā, plī, pan, or of illumination, here the being reunites with himself in a unity of pure knowledge and beatitude, here there is the perfect serenity which, rising up from the body and arriving at the supreme light, appears in its true aspect, here we are on the point of crossing that dike, beyond which he who was blind is no longer blind, he who was wounded is no longer wounded, he who was ill is no longer ill, where even night becomes day. The fourth condition corresponds to the unconditioned state, absolutely above all duality, all particular forms of manifestation, beyond both interior consciousness and exterior consciousness, and above both together. Point 24. When we spoke of the JHNA, we considered the possibility of references to transformations of this sort, and a more exact correspondence can be seen with regard to the developments in the world free from form to the Yatana. Thus, we are not unjustified in matching the Indo-Aryan traditional doctrine we have just discussed with the realizations that take place in the three watches of the night. We have a consciousness that, like a fire that advances destroying every bond, carries one beyond the state of wakefulness, leaves this state behind, advances to the state that in others would be sleep or profound sleep, and establishes itself there, dissipating ignorance, achieving wisdom, dissipating the shadows, achieving the light, just as says the Buddhist formula that refers to the supernormal knowing acquired during the first, second, and third watches of the night. Beyond the luminous or radiant state of Taijasa, beyond the state of pure illumination, prajñā, in Buddhism, would correspond to the opening of the celestial, unclouded superterrestrial, i.e. there is the unconditioned state. Turiya, the unconditioned state of the TM in the general Indo-Aryan tradition, would then correspond to the state of nirvana in the Buddhist terminology. Point 25. In such terms, the vigils of the Arya appears in the grandeur of a change in which the night is transformed into day, unconsciousness into superconsciousness, the vision of an indefinite number of existences dispersed in time spreads out like a memory, and is left behind. During the last hours of the night, where for the others sleep is deepest, at the dawning of the physical light, there dawns also that. 24. Compare to Maitreyan Upanishad, 6.19, 7.11, Mundaki Upanishad, 4.7, Chindogya Upanishad, 8.11.1, 12.3, 6.3-5, 4.1-3, etc. 25. There are also specific references with regard to the experiences that take place in the awakened one in the state corresponding to that of sleep. Compare to Sumangala Vilasini, commentary to the DGHA Nikaya. Point 47, W 94-95, where it is said that in the second watch of the night he sleeps and simultaneously enters into contact with some divinities. In the third watch, arising with his superterrestrial eye, he perceives those who have decided to tread the path of awakening. 181. Wisdom, that awakening, in which every mania is destroyed and which towers over all worlds with their ranks of angels, evil and good spirits, gods and men, ascetics and priests. Thus the accomplished one, when the final watch of the night changes into light, returns to the world of men at the moment in which the day once again shines on him, and awakening corresponds to awakening, the physical and the metaphysical elements meet, and truly may we use for him a similitude of the texts, that of the sun. When, in the last month of the rainy season, after it has dissipated and put to flight the rain-swollen clouds, it rises in the sky and disperses with its rays the mist in the air, and flashes and shines. This is the mighty appearance of the awakened one among men. Light of the world, the Buddha has been called, the light of wisdom becomes light of the world. 26. The sage, who appears in the world of men and of gods, proceeding alone, in the midst of the people, dispersing every shadow. 27. 26. Thereif, 148, quoted by De Lorenzo in his translation of Maj, Volume 2, page 65. Compare to Marparin, 52-56. 27. Sutanipta, 4.16.2. 182. 14. Discrimination between the powers. The Buddhist teaching admits the possibility of acquiring extranormal and supernormal powers, iddhi, along the path of awakening. This is one of the signs that the Buddhist ascesis does not move toward a state of nothingness, toward a crepuscular frontier between consciousness and unconsciousness, there to wait for a final annihilation, but that it is accompanied by ever greater degrees of consciousness, completeness, elevation, and power. We have no need to consider the difficulties of belief that, with regard to the iddhi, may arise in the minds of modern critical commentators. It is, of course, well known how often these individuals, after denouncing as fabulous all that touches the supernormal in the history of great figures of the past, are capable of falling into ecstasy before some petty mediumistic phenomenon that, in the ancient world, would not have merited the attention of any person of consequence. The problem of the extranormal and supernormal powers is connected with the view of the world. When nature is not conceived as an independent reality, but rather as the outward form in which immaterial forces manifest themselves, when, furthermore, one admits the possibility of removing, under certain conditions, the purely individual, sensory cerebral consciousness of a man so as to allow of positive contacts with those immaterial forces, then, assuming these premises, which are those of every normal and traditional concept of the world, the general possibility of extranormal powers follows as a natural consequence. The true problem does not, then, consist in the reality or otherwise of certain phenomena, admittedly not capable of being explained by the physical or psychical laws known today, that in the past boasted a science sui generis, of which many, although fragmentary, traces still remain. The true problem is, rather, the significance and the value to be attached to such phenomena. We have already discussed the difference between prodigies of the noble. 183. Ariyang type and those not noble, non-Aryan, anariyaridhi. We must add that, by Buddhism as by any traditional doctrine, both the quest after the powers of in themselves, and worse, the quest after them for temporal and individual ends, more or less in the spirit with which technology and the power associated therewith have been developed today, were considered not only as having nothing to do with ascetic and spiritual development, but even as being positively harmful to this development. The practice of the powers was held to be dangerous. My instruction, says the Buddha, is not this: come, zero ascetics, and acquire powers which surpass those of ordinary men. To the life that is led in the order of the accomplished one is not directed to the acquisition of powers that produce clairvoyance or clairaudience, but has a higher aim, namely, liberation. This, however, does not prevent the transcendental forms of experience and detachment that we have considered from being capable of giving rise to extranormal modes of action and of vision. And when there is adequate cause, an awakened one may use such faculties, much as an ordinary man uses his speech or his arms. The iddhi are divided in the Buddhist teaching into three sections: magical powers, powers that reveal what for the ordinary man remains hidden, powers of manifestation, and finally, powers that work in the miracle of the doctrine and of right discernment. The last are considered as the most noble and august of them all. They are the ones to which we referred when we spoke earlier of those miracles whereby there may arise in the samsaric consciousness and extra samsaric force and vocation, a will that is no longer the normal will, a will that overcomes the normal will and arrests that flux, a vision that can now discern what is noble and what is common, the rational and the irrational, the unconditioned and the conditioned. Together with the power of achieving this miracle, the awakened ones, it is said, also comprehend and acquire those of the first two sections, which we shall shortly discuss, but they fully realize that, in themselves, they have very little value. If anyone should be tempted to show them off or brag about them, he should remember that it is possible to arrive at analogous results by means of certain forms of sorcery. Thus the iddhi, the extranormal powers, are never used, in the tradition of the Aurya, even to astonish and convert men of low intellectual capacity. The miraculous phenomenology that occurs in some later Buddhist texts is clearly of a fabulous allegorical or symbolical type, just like the stories of the multiple existences. The attitude of the pure doctrine of the Aurea is almost exactly that which the last exponents of the Arian and aristocratic Roman tradition assumed. In the person of Celsus, in opposition to certain forms of 1. DGHA, 11.5 or 7. 2. Ibid, 11.1. 3. Ibid, 6.1, 13. 4. DGHA, 11.3, Angot, 3.60. 5. Dyer, 11.5 or 7. 184. Christianism. Celsus, in fact, asked what the Christians were trying to prove with all their excitement about this miracle or that, since it was well known that anyone with a taste for such things and wishing to produce similar phenomena had only to go to Egypt and learn about them from the specialists. With this in mind, let us see how we are to understand these powers that are mentioned in the texts of the oldest canon. As the starting point for the idea of manifestation, the texts postulate the purified, ductile, malleable, compact, unblemished mind, isolated from peripheral sensitivity, which is also presupposed for the achievement of the three knowings in the threefold watch. Free from the bond of the senses and of samsaric individuality, neutral, extremely balanced, this consciousness, aroused in one or other of the JHNA, can directly realize the object whose image is evoked, by producing either telepathic knowledge or objective penetration of the mind of others, or, finally, vision of distant things. 6. In this connection, we can recall a simile already quoted, just as it is enough to tip a vessel that is brimful, in a particular direction, for the water to overflow in that direction, so also, if he has devoted himself to, developed, often practiced, established and brought to its just fulfillment the right, fivefold contemplation of the Aurea, here is meant the four JHNA after being integrated by the vision projection of oneself, compare to p. I 74-75, then if he directs his mind to any element whatsoever that is susceptible of being the object of a higher knowledge, the ascetic can apprehend this element in wisdom, provided he has developed the faculty, and provided the right conditions are present. When it is applied to the persons, the minds, and the hearts of other people that the awakened one is able to observe with the same clarity and with no greater effort than every one of us can observe his own features in a mirror, 8. Such power may be regarded as an elementary grade of the first and the second knowing, which embrace multiple lives and multiple samsaric groups. In some texts, indeed, this twofold knowing is listed among the abhin or supernormal faculties, some of which are also called iddhi.9. In this case, however, we must distinguish between ascetic experiences proper, in which those knowings are the concomitants of liberation, and these powers of vision in themselves, when they are used for a particular purpose. We must not, in any case, forget that it is the celestial, supermundane eye, dibbakaku, with which the awakened one perceives the whereabouts of others of whom he is thinking, sees into the heart and mind of his interlocutors as well as of people at a distance, and perceives that a particular being, to whom he has directed his thought, is dead, and so on. 10. 6. Ibid. 2.9, 2. 7. Angot. 5.28, 8. DGHA. 2.92, 9. Ibid. 2.93, 96. 10. Maj. 4. 6, 26, 27, 36, 76, 85, 109, etc. 185. The counterpart of this latter iddhi is the faculty of supernormal hearing, dibbasota. The awakened one is able to perceive two kinds of sound, the divine and the human, the far and the near. To understand the divine or immaterial sounds, we must refer back to the traditional teachings that had already served as the basis for the Vedic doctrine of ritual and that, occurring as wisdom in the mantras, were particularly developed in some forms of yoga, and then, in the tantras. We have already discussed this elsewhere. To hear the immaterial sounds is not to perceive an indeterminate and almost mystico-aesthetic harmony of the spheres, but rather to arrive at a special form of perception of the formative forces of things and of elements, a perception that, in its working, is distantly analogous to what the common man experiences as sound. The man who is really capable of perceiving and grasping the divine sounds is then also capable of pronouncing the word that is power, the mantra. a thing that, among others, lies at the root of every liturgical practice that has not been reduced to a mere recitation. 12. Other idi considered by the texts consist of appearing and disappearing, of walking on water without sinking, of moving great distances in a moment, of wielding power over one's body right up to the world of Brahma. In order to understand that such phenomena are possible, we must start from the production of the body made of mind, manamaya, that we have already mentioned. In the text to which we are principally referring, this state occurs immediately after the contemplation projection of one's own person, compared to pages 174-75, and is given in the following terms: with this firm, purified, tense, sincere, unblemished, malleable, ductile, compact, incorruptible mind, he, the ascetic, turns toward the production of a body made of mind. From his body he extracts another body having all its organs and all its faculties, furnished with form, but supersensible. Made of mind. To illustrate this, there are similes of a man drawing a sword from its scabbard, removing the pith from a rush, or a snake from a basket. 14. An important detail that warns us not to confuse this experience with a simple act of magic is that we are here, it is said, in the realm of transcendental knowledge, Pan. 5. Besides, we have seen that the practice in question comes immediately after the apprehension of one's own person as that of another by means of the eye that has opened in the jhna. We have mentioned the transformation of the sensation that one normally has of the body. It is a matter of taking this process further by achieving an ever more detached and disindividualized consciousness, on the one hand, and on the other, by penetrating down into the deep, vital, in a superbiological sense, forces that rule the organism and that make up. 12. Compare to our The Yoga of Power. And J. W. Woodroff, The Garland of Letters, Madras, 1922. 13. Dyer, 2.87. 14. Ibid, 2.86, Maj, 77. 5. Compare to, e.g., Dyer, 2.20, 26. 186. The double, or demon, and the samsaric being in us. Here the transcendental knowledge cannot do other than produce a special transformation, if only by degrees. The transfigured mind, in this profundity, works almost, one might say, as a catalyst. It transmits its own nature to the group of forces with which it comes in contact, so that eventually the half-vital and half-opaque sensation that one has of one's bodiliness clarifies into the sensation of a transparent and luminous form. It is luminous or radiant since, actually, these experiences happen in a condition corresponding to Taijasa, that is, in the condition of luminosity or radiance that, for the awakened one, takes the place of the state of dreaming. This is the true sense of the extraction of the body made of mind, which is not another body, but a particular experience of the power of which the body is the sensible manifestation.